Brian, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
What led you to write Glass House?
Well, there's a somewhat longer version of an origin story, but the short version is that I had gone back to Lancaster, my hometown where I grew up, and was sort of surprised at a lot of the changes there. And so I began to kind of keep abreast of events. And simultaneously, I was thinking about writing a book about various trends in the country that I saw that I thought was disturbing, but that I could never get to cohere into one book because they seemed to be somehow all separated, not with a real theme. And then over time, I realized that a lot of these threads were running right through the middle of Lancaster, Ohio, and that by writing about the town, I could write about some of these powerful forces that affect not only Lancaster, but a couple of hundred other towns all over the United States. Lancaster is really an avatar for a lot of what's been going on in the country.
Well, give us an overview, Brian. What is the book about?
Well, the book's about the town, but it's also about how outside forces, in this case, mainly financial engineers, private equity companies, they used to be called leveraged buyout shops, can come in and take over a company and squeeze the value out of it to their benefit, to the, you know, the profit of the private equity firms and to the investors in the private equity firms. But it leaves the workers and the community in which those workers live dried out. It's like squeezing a wet sponge. And there's a lot of social fallout from that. You get an erosion of the social contract, and people begin to lose faith not only in business but in the American idea.
And in this case, this revolves around Anchor Hawking, which is the major employer in Lancaster.
That's right. Anchor Hawking, at one point, had about a little over 5,000 employees in Lancaster, and that was when the town's population was roughly 27,000, 28,000 people. So it was easily the largest employer in town. It was not really a company town, however. There were other employers. Diamond Power was an industrial equipment maker. Ralston Purina made snacks. If you ever had a Bugle when you were a kid, that was made in Lancaster, Ohio. There was a shoe company, a foundry, and so on. But as I point out in the book, some of those companies were also attacked by financial engineers to their detriment.
Tell us about the private equity firm in this case.
Well, there were a couple. The saga really started back in the 1980s with a guy that we all know more about these days named Carl Icahn, who executed what was then called a green mail attack on Anchor Hawking. And that really began a cascade of events. Anchor was later taken over by the Newell Corporation, and a lot of its assets were stripped away. After Newell came another private equity firm that we've heard more about lately, Cerberus Capital Management, that is run by a guy named Steven Feinberg, who's a prime advisor to Donald Trump. And then after Cerberus drove it into bankruptcy, it was picked up by another private equity firm, and they drove it into bankruptcy.
Now, you talked with a man named Sam Solomon. Sam was the man they hired to come in and take care of this whole private equity deal in the last instance. Tell us about Sam.
I like Sam a lot. Sam has a very interesting backstory. His people were essentially hired farm workers in tobacco fields in rural North Carolina. And through a long life course and some vision by his father, who joined the Air Force and sort of escaped that life, Sam eventually got an MBA from Duke University and went to work for companies like Procter & Gamble. He lived in Cincinnati for a while, worked at P&G. And then he worked for Sears and then moved on and worked, became the CEO of what was then called Everywhere Global, which was sort of the mashup of Anchor Hawking and Oneida Silverware. Sam is he let me into the company. There really wouldn't have been a book without him. He let me come in and not only interview him, but observe some meetings and somewhat embed myself in the company as it was going through a lot of this turmoil.
Did he at any point start having doubts himself about the private equity firm that had hired him?
Yes. I think he began to feel disillusioned with what was going on, with the value extraction. And there are quotes in the book where Sam is talking about how, you know, it took generations to lay down these layers of value, and it takes a very short time to mine that value. It's like almost like a geological process. You know, anchor hawking has its roots in 1905 with the Hawking Glass Company. And so for 100 years, one generation after another built the company and also helped to build the town. And in a very short period of time, a lot of that can erode away if your motivations are not the right motivations.
So Sam Solomon gave you access to the company. As you're researching for this book, did you find anything that really surprised you?
Well, I think the ability of an outside actor to grab hold of something valuable and engineer it so that they can enrich themselves and enrich their outside investors surprised me. I knew that could happen, and I knew the vague outlines of that. But to see it in action and to really sort of follow events was the most surprising thing to me, because I wasn't really I didn't feel it viscerally before I started this book. But once you've started, and then once I spent a lot of time with thousands of documents, Securities and Exchange Commission filings and so on, it really becomes very apparent how this system that most Americans really are not aware of, how this system really works.
What impact did all of this have on Lancaster?
Well, we're now a generation and a half into this destruction of the social contract, and it's had a number of effects on Lancaster. I want to say right from the beginning, though, that I still love Lancaster. Lancaster is still, despite a lot of its distress, there's a lot of great people in Lancaster, and if somebody's thinking about locating a business, they ought to go check it out. But it's had a lot of negative effects. The drug epidemic is obviously one of them. The opiate epidemic, which I know that Cincinnati has also been severely affected by, has many causes. But one of them is the sense that there's no real belonging. There's no great sort of community. And by community, I don't mean that Lancaster is not a nice community. I mean that people feel disaggregated. They feel atomized, not part of something that's bigger than themselves. And the social web phrase. And drugs are a way to not only sort of feel better, but to create a tribe. Some of the people that I follow, addicts and dealers, it became apparent to me that they have their own tribe. That is their community. That's their sense of belonging. It's sort of a perverse way of looking at it, but that's what happens. Then they also have the crumbling real estate prices. You have a lack of civic engagement. In Lancaster's case, there was a lack of effective civic government. The mayor, former mayor, ended up wearing an ankle bracelet because his wife was convicted of embezzlement. He got into some trouble. He was actually driven from office, and they're about to hold an election in Lancaster. Apparently, the GOP candidate for mayor has said that he is running because he's mad at me for writing this book. So there's been a fair amount of negative fallout in Lancaster. And one of the things is just the idea that people feel that they don't have a stake anymore, because no matter what they do, something bad's going to happen anyway.
You know, with all the town has been through, though, how do people who live there feel about it these days? I mean, they feel that they don't have a stake, but do they still treasure the town they live in?
They love this town. That is one of the greatest things and most moving things that I encountered. There is still an enormous amount of town pride. And there are a number of things that may save Lancaster. One is the fact that it's drivable from Columbus. And so a lot of people now commute to jobs up in Columbus. But another is that there is still a core of people there who are really trying to turn their town around. And they are really working hard at it. And it's because they love their town. I talk to people who probably could easily have left Lancaster and moved on to someplace where they would have had more lucrative careers and so on. But as one woman I quote in the book, she looks at me and said, when I suggest moving, she looks at me like I'm crazy and says, this is my town. I mean, there's a real amazing sense of belonging there.
I'm talking with Brian Alexander. He is the author of Glass House, The 1% Economy and the Shattering of the All-American Town. And Brian, I have to admit this, before I even started reading the book, when I first heard about the topic of the book, I immediately thought of J.D. Vance's Hillbilly Elegy. And I understand you get that reaction a lot. And I'm wondering, what makes Glass House different from Hillbilly Elegy?
Oh, boy. Well, I could do a whole hour show on
on the differences.
Yeah. Well, look, here's my J.D. Vance talk. I read Hillbilly Elegy. I liked parts of Hillbilly Elegy. I thought it was an affecting personal and family memoir. And I don't doubt his personal story. But here's where I part company. So I grew up with a lot of hillbillies. They were my friends. I went to school with them. And so what makes them or their families sort of no longer the stereotypical hillbilly that J.D. Vance portrays as being highly dysfunctional and so on? And what created that was decent jobs. So you could be a hillbilly, and you can go to work at Anchor Hocking and get paid a decent wage. And a few years after you're there, suddenly you are a skilled millwright or an electrician or a mold maker having a very responsible job, and you have a lot of pride in that job, and you are treated by the society as if you are somebody. You're not nobody. People look up to you a little bit. And you get to send your kids to a decent state university. You get to buy a bass boat. You get to have vacations. And so the next thing you know, these people are not this quote-unquote dysfunctional hillbilly anymore. They have a path that they walk. Now, J.D. is very big on personal responsibility. It's part of what I call the cult of personal responsibility. And of course, people should not take drugs. And people should probably be married before they have kids. Kids do better in two-parent families, and on and on. That's all true. But there's a pathway. You know, in J.D.'s case, he joined the Marines, and he talks about how much he learned in the Marines. Well, the Marines give you a pathway. They set out goals. You have things you've got to meet, discipline that you've got to live under, and you learn things. That's what the role that those companies used to play. When those companies are eroded away by people who are trying to extract money for themselves, that pathway disappears. And so my question is, where is their personal responsibility? Where is the personal responsibility for the high-interest payday lenders in Ohio, the car title loan vultures in Ohio? Ohio is one of the biggest states in the country for what are called CSO fees that these guys extract. There's basically an entire industry that is created to make money off poor people. It's amazing how much money there is in poverty. Where is their personal responsibility? Where is the personal responsibility for the politicians
who
allow this?
Maybe you see a bigger role for government and society than J.D. saw in his book.
Absolutely.
So is there anything that gives you hope for a brighter future for the town?
Yeah, sure. But one is this love that I just talked about. Another one is its proximity to Columbus, that it provides an outlet for people to be able to work. Another one is the fact that I think that they're trying to leverage the town's history, the town's old buildings. There are beautiful old buildings in town. They're trying to attract some businesses in there. They're trying to attract a lot of travel and tourism. I'm somewhat skeptical of that, and I express that in the book because the jobs in travel and tourism don't pay a lot. You don't pay a lot working in a gourmet coffee shop. You don't make that much. But nevertheless, there's a lot of effort going on there. And I think as Columbus continues to expand, it may almost sort of absorb Lancaster, which is not really an unalloyed good thing. There's bad stuff about that. But Lancaster is not going to go away, despite its current distress.
What's the message you'd like readers to take away from Glass House?
I want people to become aware of the way this sort of parallel economy works. And I want them to ask themselves a question. about the nature of our modern day capitalism in this country. We were all raised with the capitalist idea, and I'm a capitalist. I believe in well-regulated capitalism, absolutely. But I believe it's been perverted. And the question I think people and we all should ask ourselves is capitalism supposed to work for us? And if so, what's it supposed to do for us? What kind of a life is it supposed to help us achieve? Or are we supposed to work for capitalism? And I hope they read the book and ask themselves those sorts of questions, and also read the book and ask themselves how we got ourselves in this position and who are the people who are talking about getting us out of this position.
Brian, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you very much. I'm really looking forward to being in Cincinnati for the book festival.